The Vox Markets Podcast.
And joining me on the podcast and on video, of course, Paul Hill, full-time investor. Well, you're full-time everything, Paul, aren't you? He never sleeps. He's always on the markets. And it's been a tricky month, hasn't it? I mean, it's been hard work. I look at the AIM All share. It hit new lows since we last spoke. I've had a couple of my stocks there. It does help when a couple of your stocks do well, you know, because when it's all down, it's really depressing. But I've had a few of my stocks that do okay, which has held up my portfolio. But how have you been faring?
We'll have to come on to those a bit later. Yeah, I mean, just sort of top level, it's been pretty hard sledging in August. We had such a strong July, and it was a bit of optimism, not so much in the small cap, but certainly over there in the sort of Magnificent Seven in the States, the sort of tech titans. And a lot of that NASDAQ was overbought territory heading into the month. And then we've had the earnings, Q2 earnings season, which has come in better than feared, actually, but still 5% down compared to estimates going into about not minus 7% down. So slightly better. And we're coming to the tail end of that. We've got Nvidia tonight. But what that's meant is that because of the seasonal problems over the summer, certainly with lower volume, we've got also those, which has just started in the States. We've had it for some time in the UK, but zero traded options has added volatility to the whole mix as well. And people have gone away. And therefore, you know, you've had a lot of disinterest. You've had a lot of price, sort of like, you know, people taking a bit of profit taking. And therefore, the markets have gone down. I mean, my portfolio, like the rest the small cap sector actually has been pretty battered. I mean, I've still got a reasonable amount of cash. My biggest holding has held up. Reasonable amounts come down, but there's a few of them have been taken to the woodshed. And you always have a few sort of like, you know, problem childs in your portfolio. And one of them is Essensys, which is the software company for those large offices that I bought some time ago. Now they're coming out with a year end trading update imminently, I'm guessing maybe even tomorrow. So, and I really don't know what it's going to be saying other than it's probably going to be bad news. But the point is, the reason why I'm raising it is that, you know, if you have in your portfolio of say 10 or 12 stocks or 15 stocks or whatever it is, everybody always has something that is definitely not going the right direction. Then you've got to decide what you're going to do with it. And I definitely don't want to sell because I still think the long-term investment thesis is sound for it. But in the short term, it's going to be a challenge. But mentally wise, you obviously, you're looking at the falling share price, it's like being cut by 1,000 knives. And the way I deal with it is that I write it down to zero in my portfolio, and therefore it can't go below that. And if I get anything above zero going forward, then it gives me a profit. So mentally wise, I'm now realigned to making a big fat loss on it, but I definitely don't want to sell it because I actually still think the long-term thesis is good on it.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? On next time we speak, Paul, it'll be an excellent anniversary for AIM. It'll be basically 2 years since the high. On the 7th of September, it was at like, 1,320.
How much has it gone down over the last 24 months?
Well, exactly. Down 44.72%. That's 715 days traded there. And it's a brutal looking chart. And so, you know, if you are within the majority of that, and it is at the moment, do you know what I do? And I didn't do this previously. I will put a stop loss in on companies because if I'm buying a stock, I do look at the fundamentals and the chart. If I've got it wrong, if something happens or they come up with a trend and it starts going down, you know, 20%, I'll cut. Because in this market, like you say, with lack of liquidity and just bearish sentiment, it can sell off a lot harder and faster and longer than you think. And so I think, you know, and even taking 20% is a relief sometimes. You think, oh, God.
The problem I find with stop losses fundamentally is in small caps, liquidity is low, particularly at these type of, you know, sort of periods, etc. Now, let's look on the positive side, okay? You know, the two stocks that, or the, you know, you mentioned you're going to buy, or you bought, you're thinking about buying, you know, last time. Now, if you have a stop loss, well, obviously, I want to know which what the stocks are and how they've done. But if you have a stop loss, then equally you should have a buy sort of sell price, you know, a sort of like a sell price when it goes up, the top's price. And in a liquidity, you can zoom well past that and you could miss some profit on the table. So in that lens, let us know what the two stocks you've bought recently.
I won't put it. Listen, when I buy a stock, I'd look at fundamentals first. If it's a pre-revenue stock, you know, I look at, first of all, how much cash they have, obviously the valuation, the potential valuation, and the potential upside. but I will put a stop loss to the downside because it limits your losses. I won't put anything to the upside because I think it starts going in the right direction. And it should. If I'm buying correctly, there should be momentum with it. It should be going in the right direction.
But what if it shoots past your target price, though, Justin?
I won't. What do you mean? I never have. What do you mean? Going upwards?
Yeah.
I never have a sell on the upside. I mean, because let's be honest, the maximum it can go down is 100%, but I don't want to do that. I'll take 20%. Because if I got it wrong, if I'm buying right on the chart and I'm looking at the chart and I'm getting it right, it shouldn't go down 20%. There's something wrong there. And that's what I cut there and reassess and say, okay, I like this company, but there's something wrong here. And it could be anything, a big seller coming in and I can carry on for a long time. And in a very low liquid market, you may just wait. But maximum 100%, but if you put a stop loss in 20%, but upside, let's be honest, it's multiples of 100%. And in fact, like I said, the company I bought, and I mentioned I was trying to get some of his lack of liquidity, was Lung Life. And
you mentioned it the weekend. Yeah. I saw it go up afterwards.
Well, it went up a lot. I was up 100%, over 100% before I even did that video. And so,
well done.
And I just saw that as, I mean, you've talked to, I've watched many of your interviews, but I've seen, even though I haven't seen your face talking to me in the last 2 weeks, I've seen your face in the last month quite a few times.
Because I've been haunting you.
Yeah, Paul Pagano, the CEO of Lung Life. And I just thought, you know, what is the, whenever you look at a business, you're like, okay, what's the problem they're trying to solve? But in their case, it's lung cancer or early detection of lung cancer. Now, it's one of the biggest killers of all. You know, I mean, if you look at, you know, what people die of above the age of 60, it's pretty much heart disease and cancer. And lung cancer is the biggest killer. So they've got a huge problem there they're trying to tackle. And what's their solution is early detection, of course. You're probably more of an expert on it than me. But, you know, like 80% of cancers are caught late stage. Too late then. All you can do is care for the people. You can't cure it. Now, if you catch it early stage, you can deal with it. So that's the job they're trying to tackle. And it's a huge market. And like I said, what they have at the moment, the current standard of care, is someone goes in for a CT scan, and it's about 5 million a year in America, and they tackle in America, and then 1.57 of those have, you know, indeterminate nodules. That means they don't know what they are. So literally 70% of those people say, wait and see, come back again in a few months' time. Now, if you've got nodules in your lung, that is not ideal. First of all, the stress of having that, about 30% of people then are given a biopsy. And that's, you know, hugely expensive, first and foremost. It's about $15,000. Now, Lung Life's test is $2,000. And a CT scan's accuracy is about, 60%. Lung Life's is 89%. It costs $2,000. And one in five people who have a biopsy, 40% don't need it, by the way, have an adverse event happening, which is like a lung collapse and, in the worst case scenario, death. So in my mind, it's more accurate, it's more cost-effective, and they were down at almost cash levels, and they were literally at, I think, sub 10 million market cap, and they had rather 8-9 million of cash. And I thought, that's ridiculous. And they had a pivotal study coming out very soon this month, in fact, September coming out. They've done a pilot study, and they've done peer-reviewed studies, which all seem very good, the efficacy and data. And I thought, okay, well, let's take a nibble. I didn't start buying until it's, you know, started rising above a sort of 50-day moving average, and it started really moving then because there was no liquidity in it at all. But no, I really like it. And of course, I've learned from stuff like Plarium, the route to market can be a bit tricky, but it's not like Plarium. They're going for FDA approval, but they don't need FDA approval. But I mean, I understand that the commercialization and the route to market would be probably tricky and longer than we expect, as in most things. But I think it's a great product, and almost best in market. And now I'm up a little bit. If you know, I can see de-risk. And I didn't do that with Plarium. I was like 300% up, and I didn't do it. And it took that massive hit on that FDA knockback. But a Lung Life, I would advise people. It has risen very quickly. It may need to consolidate. But I still think, like, literally, what is it, 27 million market cap. That's the thing. I was looking at your interview, right? And one of the guys on my investment club on the webinar, I said, how many, because we've looked at it quite a few times. And I said, how many tests are they open to do? And I sort of modelled it, and I sort of did it in my head, trying to work out, you know, how much. And then they said, is it the market, but it's 3 million. I said, what? No, it's not 3 million. And, but really, you don't realise, you've got, you know, for people who have, like, CT scans, and then, it's indeterminate nodules, so 1.5 million. Now, also, the second tests and all that stuff, and there's other tests going on as well. So they may get up to that. But even at, like, silly amounts, like 10,000 a year, it should be valued where they are now. So if you do, like, you know, I said 5% of that target amount, if you do 5% of that target amount, this company could be a 10-20 bagger. So it's, you know, but again, we're still a long way to go, but I like where they are, and I just thought the valuation was silly, to be honest, to consider what they have, you know.
Yeah, and I think you've taken a brilliant opportunity, because I do understand that before you got, you know, became interested, the only reason why it went down so much was because there was a sort of like persistent seller who just kept on dripping shares into the market, which just basically just took the price so far down, even though the news was positive. And that just goes to show that there are opportunities, as you found, you know, you've identified and benefited from, in a difficult overall market to find idiosyncratic risk and to generate alpha. And I think that's another really, really key point to investors broadly, is what is your hit rate? Because most people think, I want a really high hit rate. And yes, of course, you do want the highest possible. But actually, if that stops you actually taking on sufficient risk to generate positive alpha, then you won't make your overall portfolio won't make return. So, for instance, if you decided, right, okay, I want a hit rate of 100%, you're just going to go into bonds or cash. And yes, everything all you're going to make will make a 1% or 2%, but overall, your portfolio will be absolute, won't do anything. And the danger that most people fall, there's two dangers that people fall into. First of all, they go too far on the risk curve and don't price in that risk and therefore don't generate alpha and then just capture beta. But equally, you get some really highly experienced investors who effectively are too cautious, hold large amounts of cash all the time, not just in one occasion, but all the time, and want a really, really high hit rate. And therefore, overall, their portfolio generates very little alpha. It just generates effectively secure beta. And they make 5-6%, which is fine and dandy, but it ain't going to generate the double-digit returns, the very good double-digit returns that you've made, and also the, you know, the reasonable double-digit returns that I've made over the long term, because you've got to basically decide what your optimum hit rate is going to be to match your risk tolerance to then generate the alpha that you need, rather than just going on either leverage beta or no beta at all or no alpha at all, which is what a lot of people do. Too many clever people basically as too cautious and just sit in cash or sit in a high hit rate and talk very knowledgeably about the market, but don't make good investment returns because they're not prepared to actually go further down the risk curve and generate alpha. And you've demonstrated just optically there with what you did with Lung Life. The market's down like 5 or 10% on AIM, but I mean, Lung Life's up, what, 100-200%, you know, over the last couple of months.
And it is, but it also, it's about being a little bit selective, you know. Sometimes you get one decent win and you lower your sort of almost your quality filters a little bit and go for the next one, so don't get too blasé. So now I'm going to be very selective because there are opportunities out there. And you sort of know that I'm stalking a couple of shares now that I'm looking at. I think that's undervalued. But I mean, it's still going down. I won't jump in until I can see they come up with some update that confirms what's happening. And I'm happy to let it bounce to the bottom by 20%. And then at least see it's going in the right direction, you know?
Coming back to your big pitch, I mean, and I don't know what it is because I don't think you ever told me, but let's just assume, your hit rate is...
I can tell you what I've returned.
Don't tell me what you returned. Yeah. You know, if I was guessing, given you operate at the really sharp end of, you know, your microcaps, I would guess your hit rate is less than 50% because of the risk you take over the last 30, but your returns, given what you've done, would be 20% plus over the last 10 years or something.
Well, sometimes I say, you know, I look at three things, basically. What to buy, doing research, you know, when to buy it and how to buy it. And those are three different things. And I mean, it's literally, when I say, you know, what to buy, obviously doing research on companies. When to buy it, I mean, that's looking, technically. So fundamentals first, technically second, and then what proportion of your portfolio. And, you know, we all focus on reward, first and foremost. Everyone invests in a company to focus on reward. And that clouds your judgment sometimes. So what you should be saying to yourself, essentially, okay, if this goes completely wrong, how much am I going to lose? But what am I looking to gain here? And when you get, you know, something like Lung Life was valued at, like, I think it's 7 million, okay, 8 million it was at one, and like, the cash is that level. And the market potential is huge. All you have to wait for, essentially, because you've done the research on the product, it looks very good from test results. all you have to do is wait for the salad to dry up and then just take the position, and if it goes in the right direction, you can average up a little bit. But, yeah, I looked at my portfolio last week, and I actually managed to do compound annual growth. That messed me up trying to figure that out. That's a complex look. But I've done, since November 2009, I've done 2,400%. Now, that was bigger than that about last year. It was about close to 3,500. I was getting close to 5,000, I think. But that's compound annual growth has started small of 30.28% over those years. And that's because I've gone into, I've done multiples on some big stocks, but go big when it starts going right. But then again, don't go massive straight away on companies that are going wrong, because that, try and pivot your portfolio towards your winners, not your losers. And that's,
But I mean, that's more of a sort of like, your early stage VC strategy, because that's what they do. They put in, 10, 20 positions. They have a hit, half will go bust or they'll make no money at all.
Yeah.
Five of them will be just winners and knock the ball out of the park, and then the rest will be basically flat. But overall, they'll make strong double-digit returns, and that's exactly the example I'm saying, in terms you've got to optimize your hit rate to generate the alpha and the extra performance. Because if you're too scared about making losses, you're too cautious, you may be of the brightest pin in the box. Yeah. But frankly, you will not make very good long. Your portfolio will make not very good. It may not make it. May not have much volatility. It may just be just a straight line. But it won't be very inclined. Whereas yours and mine's in the middle. But yours is more volatile and faster and higher returns overall, because you've generated far more alpha than I have. But mine is sort of like mine's volatile enough for me that I can sleep at night, as I can't. So that is the trick, and that's the point I'm highlighting to investors. You have to choose what your optimum level of hit rate is that you want to achieve the returns that you need to then where you play and how much alpha you want to generate. You don't just go for beta, which is basically just leveraging up your portfolio or whatever it is, or just stick it in cash, because you won't make any returns. Because I mean, as soon as you invest where there's certainty, which is what a lot of very bright people do, there's no returns. The market's moved.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's like there are plenty of very clever professors of economics out there who couldn't invest and make money in the markets, absolutely. And in fact, the book was worth reading? I don't know if you, about 6 years back, I interviewed a guy called Lee Freeman Shaw, and he's called The Art of Execution. He's a fund manager, and he used to manage sort of buyers and his fund managers within that. And he said how the best investors lose on most of their stocks but still make money. And that's exactly what he's talking about. He categorized them into hunters, rabbits, and all this. But essentially said the ones that had conviction plays, and literally, even if it dipped down and the results came out, the registered results, and they said, okay, I'm going to go bigger on this. And conversely, if one went down, they didn't like the results, they wouldn't. And they wouldn't pull the trigger on them. But some people, the share price would go down and they just sell out, and they would, regardless of what they read. So, it's about reading into that. It's worth a book, The Art of Execution by Lee Freeman Shaw. It's an excellent book, very easy to read. But I'd recommend it. Just shows, you don't have to have, 90% winners. Like you say, you could do 50% or less, as long as you go big on those ones who do win.
Yes, yeah. Or you could do 10%, but still not the ball out of the park. All I'm saying is that hit rate is just a number that actually should represent should be optimized to represent the return that you want, and the amount of alpha that you want, and the volatility that you can accept. And being bright and living in an ivory tower and having great knowledge about economics and every single stock in the world doesn't necessarily mean you're a good investor if you just operate at that effectively super secure, no volatility part of the risk curve, because you'll make no money.
Yeah. Well, I know some. I mean, you have to be a little bit sort of bright, but you have to be super bright. I know people. No. I know a guy.
I'm as daft as the best of them.
No, but you are intelligent. But I know guys. The guy from sort of South Wales, and he was in remedials in school, but he always he didn't go to school, did that, but he always started businesses, right? And he was a little bit stupid, and he didn't really see much risk, but he's done very, very well, because he doesn't, you know, whereas intelligent people would weigh up the risk too much and get worried by it too much. Yeah. I mean, there's extremes, of course, but he's lucky that he's tried so many things, but he's done very, he's very, very wealthy. He's a multi-millionaire, and yet he hasn't got one O-level, one GCSE to his name, he never went to school. Mm. But he's one of those guys that doesn't see the risk so much, you know? And if you're too intelligent, you worry too much about the risk, you know?
Yeah. Anyway. And one risk that is coming up, obviously, you know, this has acted, has been a lead weight on the market, you know, this month, has been the increase in that 10-year treasury out in the States. And the point I'm making here, which I'd like to highlight to investors, is we are now seeing that inverted yield curve starting to re-steepen, and they call it the bear steepening. Mm. And what's been surprising is that, you know, that normally signifies when the recession is going to start. But what's been surprising is at the start of the year, most people thought the bear steepening would be the front end of the curve. The short-term interest rates would be falling as we put into a recession, which was the Federal Reserve would be forced into juicing the economy. But actually what's happened, the economy's been stronger than expected. Wage inflation's been stronger than expected. And it's the long end of the curve, which has actually risen higher. And you're starting to see those interest rate cuts for next year getting pushed to the right and priced out the market. And that means bond investors are getting more comfortable with the Federal Reserve mantra. And we'll hear more about it from Jerome Powell at his Jackson Hole speech on Friday. But bond investors are getting more comfortable that it's going to be higher for longer as the longer end of the yield curve gets increases and those interest rates get pushed out. So I think we've got to bake in 4.5, sort of like, you know, 10-year, for the next 10 years, really, interest rates. And it's about 4.3. And you can see that because, you know, that's assuming we don't get a really, really hard, you know, hard landing and a recession, which seems they can't. It all comes down to, as I said, the strength of the labour market and in wage inflation, in my view, because that's really the nuts and bolts of it. And whether the central banks want to keep a 2% CPI target, because if they do, then that sort of like handcuffs them a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's why I think at the moment you've got to be very selective, and because I'm holding about 32% cash, but I mean I'm going to be super selective. Only when I actually know, or you know, I have a lot of confidence in the company, will I actually pull the trigger now, because it's going to be volatile for a while. And
incidentally, do you know why they have a 2% CPI target? Why they picked 2%?
I saw that Jerome Powell interview where he couldn't really explain it. That's always been told. It's just sort of an arbitrary figure. Because if people, it's what he said, if people sort of say, let's think of 5%, it'll all go towards 5% or 2%. But I have no idea why they've got that. I assume it's enough to keep the economy going, because prices will, you know, gradually go up. So it'll motivate people to buy, because if you don't buy now, it'll be, you know, a couple percent more expensive in a couple of years' time. But I have no idea. Why is that?
Okay, well, I'll help Jerome Powell then in that case, because I'll give him a bit of...
He looked lost. He was a central banker.
Yeah,
he didn't know what you're talking about.
Okay, the ivory tower view, right, of 2%. It is an arbitrary figure, but the ivory tower view is that for a growing, vibrant economy, typically you want interest rates as low as possible, yeah, because it means that the cost of capital is relatively cheap for companies to invest, etc. Okay, now you have an assumed real yield, i.e., you know, real interest rate yield of about 1 or 1.5%, or even, you know, it's 2% at the moment, but that's sort of like, you know, is your neutral level. So when you're setting your CPI target, you want interest rates as low as possible. So you want your CPI as low as possible as your target. But equally, you don't want it ever inflation below zero, because deflation destroys the economy, as you've seen in Japan. Now, when you go into recession, typically CPI drops by 1.5%. So if you have a target of 2%, that gives you enough margin of safety to absorb a 1.5% fall and leave you with 0.5% on the downside. So it's the 2% is effectively a figure in between avoiding deflation on the downside during a recession but keeping it as low as possible so you can effectively give the economy relatively cheap fixed income and bonds to be able to fund itself to grow and create jobs. So that's what that's the ivory tower view.
I know they needed you in Jerome's ear, I think. Jerome, this is what it's about. You're looking lost, fella.
but most people don't know it, you know, and I thought it would just be quite useful just to sort of highlight it to investors.
Yeah. Okay, so any stocks news?
I've had a couple, but I mean, there's another one out that medical side, you know, just following on from Lung Life, Bellascura. I think you've seen it last week. I interviewed the guys out there, Bob Rauker and Bob Fari, who's the sales director, and they've just absolutely knocked the ball out of the park in terms of taking pre-orders for their new portable oxygen concentrator, the Discover device. It hasn't actually been launched yet. It's going to be done shortly. And they've taken $15 million of pre-orders, and it could have been multiple more than that as pre-orders. They said on the tape that they've had to stop and effectively ration the product, which equates to about 6,500 units. And, you know, I remember when they did the first sort of like, they released it or they showed it off and showcased it at this big industry conference. And people were saying then, if you have it available, I'll buy it now. And that was like 3 or 4 months ago. And that's what they've done. So what that means is that they have fantastic visibility over their top line growth, assuming that they can get the production. Now, the first devices are being manufactured in the US. And then next year, they're going to shift production or transfer some of the production to their Chinese partner, Inomax, out in, I think it's Shanghai or somewhere like that. It's part of Foxconn, I think. And also there's some state ownership as well. So they're pretty well protected. And if that can actually start pumping out a lot of devices, I mean, they'll knock out the ball out the park in terms of their forecast. Dowgate, house broker, have got a price target. I think it's about £1. The shares are trading about 40p. But the key is unbelievable pent up demand for this best in class portable oxygen concentrator that they could be selling out for like Nvidia. They could be selling out these portable oxygen concentrators for years. And the US is a massive market. But China is absolutely colossal. There's 100 million people who suffer from COPD, and also the respiratory conditions in India with the air quality, and out in Japan where they smoke as well. They're really in a very good position. It comes down to a bit like Lung Life now. It's execution. They've just got to get that. They've got to ramp up that supply chain, get the product out to relevant quality, and then they'll be doing really well.
Do you know what? I like the chart there. In fact, we covered it on Taking Stock with John. But I said you bounced off a low here, basically at 23 pence, and it was previous support, which was 45 pence. So it's broken that. It's on the 200. It literally, if it gets above 45, I think it's going up quickly because it's done that. It's tested it, come back down a little bit, but it's now at 43. It's not far off there. But that was that 45 was previous support there and a little bit of resistance there. And if it gets above that, I think it's off to the races there.
And the other thing with both Lung Life and Bellascura that I know is a sort of like a, you know, it's optionality, but it's important if you're an investor. These things could just get bought out anytime by a big diagnostics company, somebody like Roche, who I own, would just lap up Lung Life, would love it. You know, it'd be like, fantastic. I'll have that. Thanks very much. In my diagnostics business, over a much larger footprint, dealing with, you know, immunotherapies, and we'll have companion diagnostics on the back of it. Fabulous. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant.
And let's be honest, they're well connected. Have you seen the shareholder register? It's literally some big names amongst that.
Likewise, with Bellascura, because they could easily be bought out by any medical device company because they've got the top, you know, one of the big operators, you know, it could be Inogen or it could be Philips or anybody like that would love it, or somebody wants to go into the adjacent market because they could just, you know, buy it with loose change for them. So plenty of upside there. Well, another one which came out with some good results, fantastic results actually, despite the sort of cost of living crisis, was Cake Box this week, and they had a trading update, and what their momentum as their like for like sales has really rocketed. 12 months ago, they had 1% decline in like for like store sales. Okay, franchisee store sales. That the second half of last year, so just over. What about between 6 to 12 months ago, it went to 3.5% positive. So -1 to 3.5. The first 11 weeks of this year went to 5.5. And then this last over the first 17 weeks, it's gone to 6.5, just over. Which, if you work it all out, works out for the last 6 weeks, it's about near 9% increase. They've gone from -1 to 3.5 to 5.5, and then the last 6 weeks they're almost at 9% like for like growth. I mean, yeah. And I quizzed the CEO Sukh Chamdal on it, and he basically said, "Look, we've got our mojo back. The business is now back to normalization. The cost of living crisis." Yeah, they had a confluence of knocks last summer. This time they had the hot weather, which put people off actually, you know, eating fresh cream cakes. They wanted ice creams instead. Mm. They had everybody going abroad on holidays because they'd had the previous year in 2021, everybody had been staycation. So you had really, really tough comps. And you had obviously the lockdowns where they were effectively, you know, they were still open and operating in 2021. And that cost of living crisis, most importantly, the big shock, which just sort of like dialed down some discretionary spend. That has all moved out the system and the business is back to A1. They're increasing their deposits. And this is despite sort of like high interest rates and, you know, less spend on disposables, you know, so sort of like discretionary spend. And Sukh said to me, he said, you know, people, the importance of birthdays and family celebrations is just demonstrated because, you know, they're essential to bring people together to socialize. And if you're gonna spend 40-50 quid on a beautiful gatto, you know, to impress your family and friends, then you do, because it's only once a quarter, whatever it is, and that's how it's sort of borne out. Good margins, excellent cash flow generation. And the shares moved up about 5 or 10% on the day. And there's also actually a, you know, there has been a bidder recently in the market for Kate Butler. There was River Capital, the Australian cheesecake shop owner, mm-hmm. who was interested, put a non-unsolicited offer of about £1.60 on the shares. So that puts a floor on it.
Cheeky cheesecake shop bid, eh? But that chart is looking good as well. It's off the bottoms. I've seen a lot of, you know, smaller micro cap stocks doing this, hitting the bottom and rising. I mean, the AIM-ALL share is still down a bit, but I am seeing a lot, generally, you know, decent businesses bouncing off the bottom. And I don't know how long we're going to be here for. But it's almost like
you could do some more long life bounces off the bottom, couldn't we?
Yeah, that was. I mean, that's a ridiculous bounce. I mean, if you look at this,
what's the other share that you were? Can you reveal it yet at all?
Well, do you know what? I may wait until I come back.
Yeah, okay, no problem. I don't want to push you into it. No, yeah, I mean, if you're not ready, particularly if you're sort of like still accumulating, it wouldn't be fair.
But put it this way, I have people want to do research. I have, you know, interviewed the CEO in the last.
Okay, so you know it. You've done your due diligence.
Yeah. I've been watching them for a while, and I do like them. And they're also in sort of, you know, med tech as well. But they're a bit more advanced than Long Life is in. They've got revenues, they need profit and stuff like that. But that's
so. What's your overall going forward for the last 6 months? Then, what's your overall strategy? In fact, sort of like, you know, your portfolio construction, your deployment of that cash. How are you looking at it?
So my biggest, in fact, it's one of my worst performers, but my biggest holding is that fund where it's a high dividend yielding, it's a BlackRock IUKD fund, which is the FTSE 350, pretty much high yielders, dividend paying. It's quarterly payment, it's an ETF. I own about 17% is that, but I've got 32% in cash of late. I still hold,
with that cash though, I mean, how are you thinking about deploying it? Over what sort of timescales? What sort of, is it small cap, large cap? Is it which sectors are you looking at?
Well, do you know, I've tried to diversify. Some of the mistakes I made in the bear market, right, was literally I was too big on many micro caps. And when you're in a bull market, it's fine, liquidity is fine. But you feel like when it's going down, it's not. You know, there's very lack of liquidity, you can't get out. So I now limit my initial exposure to sort of micro caps at the moment. The liquidity improves once the share price is going up. Of course it does. But for liquidity purposes, I'll have cash. And by the way, I put 1% of my total portfolio value into that fund every month, and they'll continue doing that. And essentially, everything else is a feeder fund for that. So by the end of the day, in a couple of years' time, I want to be earning sort of you know,
six figure,
you know, income off that, basically. So that's a feeder fund for that. But in the meantime, I'm always looking, I'm tempted by rubbish sometimes, but
Don't buy rubbish.
I know, there's got to be, because I've seen a lot of, you know, almost like trash rallying very hard of late. And I think, no, I don't like it. It's annoying when you see the share price go. And you think, I don't like it. And but no, I've got about four companies I'm looking at. And I quite like them, and I've done the fundamental research. I said, you know, what to buy, but when to buy. They're still in a little bit of a downtrend, and until that sort of changes, they have bounce or trading update that stops that, then I'm not going to press the trigger. I've messed around with Future PLC a couple of times. I want to get into that. I think it's going to be a long, you know, longer term be fine, but it's just literally, it's one of those shortest stocks. It's quite volatile for a big stock. So, but yeah, I still know my holdings are like, you know, XPF factory, you know, Good Energy. I've got mentioned Tecma recently. Trufin still hold. Destiny Pharma, IUKD, Lung Life. There's one more in there that I just mentioned there, but I haven't mentioned the name. But I'll talk about it.
Yeah, okay,
but,
that's good. Okay, yeah, yeah. So,
but I mean, as yet, it's almost like, you know, I think we're on a knife edge here. I think over time, you know, the next couple of months, I think we'll start to see. It's central bank led, isn't it? Let's be honest. When we start seeing some kind of easing from them, or some kind of pause from them, well, I think the Bank of England should pause, because they said themselves, 2 years it takes to have an effect, and yet we haven't, not even 2 years in yet, and you can start seeing things rolling over already. So just pause, Bank of England, because you could damage a lot of people, a lot of livelihoods, by carrying on ratcheting it up when you don't know the actual effect of it. But it's central bank led.
So, just to run that one, if they did what you said that, you know, you recommended, how would they get wage inflation down from 8% at the moment? Because effectively, if you look at the unions and, you know, public sector, they're getting 5-6% wage increases. How are you going to get that?
Yeah, but that's historical. It's not going to carry on like that. I mean, if you saw what was the data I was doing yesterday, I read so much data now, I'm taking stock, but there was a reduction in the people are just pulling job adverts. They're also job inflation's got wage inflation's gone down. I can't think of the data. I should have brought it up. But there's quite a few data points now showing that's rolling over, and it's not happening. I mean, so the labour market's loosening up a bit. So I just think that won't happen. I mean, business is going to start to struggle in the next few months. They're not going to start giving pay rises. They'll just let people go. I mean, there will be, honestly, we are going into recession. I mean, and there'll be a lot more struggle unless if they keep it high for longer. There'll be a lot more bankruptcies going on. I mean, people will be struggling. We haven't seen the start of this yet. Literally, like I said, if you go back 18 months, then you just started, you know, hiking interest rates. We're now at 5.25%, and they're going to hold them for 2 years. And they say, are you kidding? No, you won't. They'll crater the economy. And we are seeing that. There will be, and once it starts spiraling down, it'll get worse and worse. And like I said, all you need is a couple of big players to, you know, go bankrupt. And everything will, I honestly think it'll change very quickly over the next 6 months.
Just playing devil's advocate on that one. The reason why the banks are so skittish on it, is that during the 70s, when they did exactly what you've suggested, they stopped, because they thought it was going to, you know, it would have follow through effects. You then got to re-accelerate. Because what happens is that as soon as the bank stops, you get investment coming back into the market and companies then stop, you know, rebalancing their workforce. So you don't get that actual decrease in wages. You don't get the loosening of the labour market because people then say, right, okay, it's another investment cycle. We're just starting another bull market. And therefore, 6 months later, you get a re-acceleration of inflation, particularly wage inflation. And therefore, when the second time you're around, you're starting at 5 or 6% interest rates, and you're having to go to 7 or 8. And that's the point that
I don't think they should bring them down yet, but I think they should pause to see the effects of it, because they don't know what.
Yeah, but that's what they did. That's what they did in the '70s. They paused. That was the problem. They paused too early.
I know. So no, didn't they start winding down? So job vacancies and starting salaries fall for the first time this year amid rate hikes. There are potentially early signs that the labour market is losing some of its inflationary heat in a shift that could give the Bank of England reason to pause. So data from job search website shows that vacancies and advertised starting salaries both fell in July, the first monthly decline in both elements this year. So you're starting to see that. There's also just you know, supermarket data yesterday saying 60% of people, you know, are cutting back and it can be affected adversely over the next year or so.
They're stealing, saying, aren't they?
We've got the amount of what they call it.
They call it shrinkage, don't they? Sort of like retail
really
shrinkage.
It's getting really bad in America. Is it
gangs? Huge, huge.
But even like PPI, we've seen PPI has contracted for 2 months in a row now. It's not just going down, it's contracted, you know, and so that's a forward-looking figure. So there are things happening, and it's going in the right direction. I think to keep ramping up here, keep going, I don't think you need to. I think it's starting to show. Remember, there's a very big lag effect, and most economists are saying you don't know what the effects of this. It does take 2 years. Even the Bank of England says it takes 2 years. So why do you keep ramping up? You don't know what you're doing.
But they paused too early last time. They paused and held too early. This is what they're spooked about.
Yeah, but remember in the '70s, the labour market was a little bit different. You know, there were sort of labor.
Yes, it was. It was much harder, the labour market, agreed, and it was a more insular type of economy, and there was lots of sort of like blockages and all this sort of stuff. I get it. So it's more, at least labour is a bit more flexible, and with technology overlay, the inflation should come down. But that's what when I said I'm playing devil's advocate, that's what spooked in the central banks. If you pause and hold too soon, then you get people like me and you thinking, wow, investment cycle. You get CEOs, great, new investment cycle. Let's start investing and let's hold on to our staff. And therefore you don't get all your leading indicators that you've seen then start to reverse because it doesn't actually happen. And it's finding that right time point. And I get it. There will be a time when you've got to make a judgment call about when you need to basically hold and then decrease. And that's the problem that Jerome Powell has. And now the bond market is saying, actually, we're not going to, the economy is too strong. The labor market is too tight. And that's why they're pricing out interest rate cuts. And they're, you know, simply because they see the reacceleration of inflation if they stop too soon.
Yeah, so explain to me. I said something yesterday on Ticket Stock, and I wasn't quite sure. Rents, right? Are they included in core inflation? Because I know, you know,
in the UK,
yeah,
yes, they are. In the RPI, you have housing costs included in it. I think rents are included in CPI, but they also put a notional, effectively, cost for people like me and you who own our houses rather than have mortgages into RPI to calculate that index. So there's another element of it. There's like an owner's occupied RPI, which, you know, so effectively includes people who are full property owners.
Well, this is the problem. They look at core, you know, inflation, right? And what they don't understand is a lot of people rent in this country, a lot of people own. You know,
third.
So when they're putting up interest rates, you know, you've got sort of, you know, landlords, a lot of them mortgaged, going to have to up their rents. So it gets to a stage where, you know, it's counterproductive to keep putting up, you know, interest rates because it's not going to help core inflation, which they're looking at. So hang on a second, just pause a second. I just think they just need to pause. That's all I think. They have no idea of the effects of the lag of it as all. But and also, you know, it won't hurt the stock market.
Well, that's the thing. As soon as they do, it's game on again. And that's the point that small caps are then going to start rallying hard. Once they pause, they're going to rally hard, no doubt about it, because people are going to start saying, right, okay, the cost of capital is now peaked out. If anything, it's coming down, and therefore it's going to help small caps. And we know for certain what the downside is because we've just reached it, and therefore it's only upside. So we'll throw the dice, and then you'll start seeing an inflow are into small cap fund managers of, you know, sort of like, you know, retail investors putting money back to the market for the fund managers then to buy, because they've been absolutely, you know, killed over the last 18 months with redemptions, and that's added to the actual selling pressure. So you're exactly right. The pivot point for small caps is when have interest rates peaked?
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, they say that in fact, nationwide reduced mortgage rates. Was it yesterday, the day before, by 0.4%, I think, generally. So they're seeing, I think we're very close. I mean, is it one or two, maybe more, you know, quarter of a point percent rates? But
The property market is absolutely crucial, not just because lots of people own properties, but actually it's a huge multiplier effect throughout the economy, through the supply chain, through your DIY stores, through people, you know, effectively updating their houses, renovating their houses once they've bought, and then it obviously improves things like the, you know, the agent, the retail, you know, the estate agents and building contractors and building products companies. I mean, and his employment. I mean, it's just a huge, big multiplier effect. It's like the car industry, huge supply chain associated with it.
And in fact, you know, and generally, you know, people feel better off when their house price is going up. It's like, you know, the first time ever, isn't it? I mean, to see Crest Nicholson's, it was quite scary. I mean, that took the wind out of the housing market, isn't it? Crest Nicholson recently. But yeah, you know, I mean, I think we've got, it's one of these bumpy roads. It's been a long, if you're an investor, you started investing, I feel sorry for you in the bull market, which is when most investors get attracted to investing, is when their mates are talking about doing well in the stock market. And so they generally tend, if new investors generally tend to start investing at the top of the bull market or close to. So if you did invest in the summer of 21, round about there, or earlier than that, and you are where we are now, remember, it's, you know, baptism of fire you've had, because you've had 2 years, if you're in micro caps, small caps, and AIM, 2 years it's gone down for. That's a hard market, you know, it's a difficult market. You know, really
you got a bit more resilient. How's your portfolio done this year then?
Let's be honest, I lost about 50% of it over the last 18 months, but last quarter, I've probably done okay. It's starting to move in the right direction, but it's part of the defensive moves I've made and being a bit more.
Are you positive year to date?
I'll have to check. I've been scared to look at it.
No, that's a good approach. That's a good approach. You know.
Well, do you know what? The reason why I looked at the compound annual growth rate is because I thought, do you know what? Even with that horrible 2 years, I've done really, really well since 2009, and that's the way to sort of look at it. I mean, I've still done better than if I just put it in a fund or whatever, or you know. So. Yeah, so that's the way I look at it. But it's gutting that I didn't take faster action, you know, of cutting losses on the way down. But going back, hindsight's a wonderful thing. And it's obvious looking back now, even the indicators, you know, the markets are rolling over. And next time, I'll be more...
I mean, my portfolio, I have drawdowns 20, 30, 40, you know, those pile of percents, and much more on individual stocks. And, you know, I haven't done as much as you. I mean, but over what... 23 years, just over 23 and a half years, I've done 15% per annum. And I'm delighted with that. You know, for me, that's absolutely, you know, means I haven't got to work. I just basically, you know, invest, which is really, really good. But that comes back to the original point we both made. It's finding it's optimizing your hit rate to give you alpha that you need over the long term, and how much downside and upside you want to, you know, volatility you're prepared to take. Because as I say, there's too many. There's lots of people who are much brighter than us two, who basically know the ins and outs of the markets, but are just too risk averse and won't take anything more than a 10% drawdown, and therefore will always stick into very, very safe. There may be high hit rate investments, but they'll make inflation type returns for the rest of their life. But, you know, do you really want to do that with your spare cash? You might as well chuck it into property because you'll make 6%.
You may as well just put it in a fund. You know, there are funds out there. They'll do that for you. Tracker funds, low cost, well diversified.
Just buy a bond now, because that'll make you 5%.
Exactly. Well, 15%, like you say, is very good, because when you've got like an eight-figure portfolio value like yours, and it's hard to get those kind of returns, isn't it? So,
it's done me perfectly well. So I've really got, I've got absolutely no problem. But it shows you.
It's not only that. It's like, it's enjoyable, you know. It's like
it is when it goes up. It isn't when it goes down.
It's been really hard. Like I gotta say, over the last couple of years, I find it really hard. But literally in the last few months, I've started to feel a bit better. I'm a lot more in control. For a while, it's almost like even if you have one or two winners, it's quite nice, you know. Over the last couple of years, I've had hardly any winners. It's like, it's so hard. Yeah, but you know what? Some of the things, who was it? One of the guests, is this guy, one of the best investors of all, and he had like 3 or 4 years. We had a really bad, and everyone was going to, I can't think who it was, Jeremy, you know. Anyway, everyone's going to tech stocks, and he didn't. And people are leaving him. And
they called him Dr. Doom, I think they did.
Yeah, but people are leaving him. And in the end, at the height of the tech bubble, his fund actually kicked him out and said, we're letting you go. And he started his own fund. And all of a sudden, the tech bump, popped. But it's like, you know, you can have that. You have periods of time where it's not going away. And if in a downturn, that can happen. But as long as you stick to, it's almost going to get, you do lose a bit of confidence sometimes. You think, am I doing the right thing here? What's going on? It worked before, you know, why is it working now? But yeah, it's almost getting that back and enjoying it again, because it's been hard. It's still hard, but I think we've gone through the hardest part. I mean, as I say, the AIM All Shares down 45%. How much more could it go down? It's 2 years it's taken. It's been awful, you know. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm the same with you. I'm actually sort of like, you know, a bit sort of bearish short term, still on the economy, but actually long term on small caps. There's too much good value out there, and just be patient. You know, I've got spare cash, just deploy it in the right opportunities. And yes, you're going to get hit. You're going to get hit with idiosyncratic risk occasionally, but overall, if you've optimized your portfolio, then you're going to make good returns. And you just got to take you can be wrong for a long period until the market sees value.
Yeah, yeah. And that's right, actually. You know, make sure, I mean, don't chase things that have gone too high, because it's a bear market. They don't keep going up like that. You've got to find like that as a margin of safety. Get that point where they are so cheap. It's just almost a no-brainer thing. That's ridiculous. You know, that's where it is. You know, Lung Life or something like that. I jumped into it. I just thought, that's just silly. And in fact, before on Verici and Seattle, when I jumped into those, I just got this level where I thought, that's silly price. You know, it's just nothing's priced in potential-wise.
And the other important bit, and this is a total credit to you, Justin, you know, is you have to keep learning, because you can't just stay a one-trick pony. I mean, you know, you've absolutely added on, you know, not only the depth and the rigor of your sort of stock selection, but also that macro view and understanding the different key levers in the economy and all this sort of stuff. Because you can hear it.
Do you understand what you're talking about?
I remember 2 years ago,
you talked about bonds. Are they boring?
Yes, you did.
But I realised then, in fact, that they're quite important because, you know,
they're coming from.
Not having a deep, you know, knowledge of them, but knowing about them. I've got a menu of bonds on my charts, and I have all set of levels on them. I get alerts on all the bond levels now, so inversion of the yield curve, everything. So, no, it does help a lot, you know. So
and then, like this morning, you know, you've got an opinion on what the Bank of England's Andrew Bailey should do. You only get that opinion because you've done the analysis, you've done the research, and you've come to that view. You wouldn't have even been bothered to have done the research and to have a view about what 3 years ago. So it just shows you how much, you know, you've just got to keep on learning, haven't you?
Yeah. Oh, and that's the thing is, that is the key. When you stop learning, you may as well die, you know, because that's the point of human beings. That's why the most successfully evolved creature on the planet, pretty much, because we do learn very quickly, you know. Yeah. And in fact, we've now taught computers to learn, which is a bit scary. we are not artificial intelligence, we're real intelligence. And that's the whole point of living. And the whole point of this game is you learn about it. And if you make mistakes, write them down, think what went wrong there. And and then you also look at the winners and say, what went right there? You just keep doing that. And, like, you know, it's and you'll make your way forward in some way, you know, because we'll all make mistakes. But that's a blessing sometimes, you know. It literally is. Yeah. This bear market has taught me so much. It's, you know, bull markets, you don't learn so much because everything is going in the same way, sort of. But in a bear market, you have to really get better or you can get wiped out, you know, simple as that. And so, yeah, it's a learning curve. A bloody
good man.
The curve's still going down. When the learning curve going to go back up.
I'm looking forward to hearing what the other stock. If that's if you're
oh,
ready
it's
to,
a cracker.
To reveal it.
It's an absolute cracker. Speak in a couple of weeks.
Cheers, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.